This is Kelly Gregor conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Terry DuBose. Today is 17 April 2018. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. DuBose is joining me by telephone from Austin, Texas. Terry, to begin the interview, I'd like to get some biographical and background information from you. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Brownfield on March 3rd, 1944.
Brownfield, Texas, just down the road from us.
Right, 35 miles southwest.
Yeah.
Used to be cotton country. Now Terry County is the capital of Texas. There's some vineyards up there that are over 800 acres.
Is that right? I didn't realize there's that many grapes up there.
They found it's declines there because it's they've got those breezes all the time. Cool nights and hot days, and grapes don't take as much water once they're established as cotton, which used to be king out there. But cotton, since it's annual up there, it has to be replanted, so there's never roots much deeper than a couple of feet. And with grapes, they go deeper and deeper and deeper, and the deeper roots get,
they have an awful lot of vineyards up here, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about growing up in Brownfield, Terry. What was life like? Tell me about your parents.
Well, Dad owned a truck stop on the highway between, it went toward New Mexico, Roswell, that way. And then there was the cutoff that intersected it. Gulf Service Station, a very large garage, cafe. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom, but she was a master seamstress. She occupied herself making clothes for people.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
Two sisters, both older considerably. My eldest 12 years older than me. She died about a year and a half ago. And the one I call the younger sister, who was 8 years older than I am, is still fine. But she's, after her husband died, this past year. And so she has moved into a retirement home. Always been real close. My oldest sister was more like an aunt, but she got married as soon as she got out of high school, which was either the year before or in first grade. So I didn't know her as well as Eddie, my 8 year old. She was 8 years older than me. But they spoiled me. I think I was like a dolls.
Well, tell me about growing up there. What sort of things did you like to do? What sort of activities were you involved in?
Well, in junior high, I got a pretty bad knee injury playing football, so I never went back to playing football. And worked straight through all the schools.
Did you work for your dad in the garage?
I did for a while when I was about 14. I would sweep up, scatter that stuff that absorbs oil spills, and sweep it up and stuff. And then one summer, I guess it was my sophomore, I spent the entire summer painting the whole truck stop. The garage, the service station, the cafe. Mom and I got interested in gardening. pit pea pods so that in the spring they would be ready.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for the Brownsville Floral. They saw that I was really interested in plants. So I became a greenhouse attendant for them and delivered.
I can hear you, a little faint, but I can certainly hear you, sure.
Well, there's a buzz going on.
Oh, is there?
Lucy's got her dance class done. She's vacuuming. I'm going to go into this other room.
Oh, okay, sure.
And hopefully in a minute, foul your recording. Anyway, I measured land for the Department of Agriculture every summer. My senior year, by President, interviewed all the recruiters that these corporations send your senior year.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically, I graduated in 66, and they basically had a script to help me by. And they would ask about three questions. Can you get a medical deferment? Getting the National Guard unit, of course, in 66. Johnson was cranking up the war.
Right.
And there was 3 and 4 year waiting list for National Guard. Danny Quayle and George W. could get in, but their dad pulled the full string. Dad was not on the tank in West Texas.
Right, yeah. Different set of rules.
Yeah, and they would ask if you could get a medical deferment, get in the National Guard unit, or I can't remember what the third was. And then after those three questions, they would stand up and hand me a business card and say, call us in 2 years. Because they weren't willing to put somebody, the expense into somebody for what in those days was a sort of buzzword. JET program, Junior Executive Training.
Mm-hmm.
And they just weren't willing because they knew I was going to be drafted.
Yeah.
And so I went back to measuring land after I graduated that last summer. Kind of fell into a depression at the end there of the summer because I had to finish measuring the farms I was measuring. Finish all the cotton allotment measurement in August and September before they can harvest. So I knew if I stayed in Brownsville, I'd probably never get out of there, and I didn't want to live in Brownsville. So in July, I went up and enlisted, and I was pretty naive, like I said.
So there was nothing going on campus there at Hardin-Simmons, either for or opposed to the war at that point?
Well, no, really there wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty conservative Baptist campus.
Sure.
And my senior year, there was an incident where there was this sort of a weird radical over at ACC, Abilene Christian College.
Mm-hmm.
And he approached the city council. He wanted to organize a protest march in Abilene supporting our troops in Vietnam. Not an anti-war march, but a pro. Excuse me. And the student vice president of McMurray, which is Methodist, said their campus was against the war and they weren't going to participate in anything that was supporting the war. And so I was getting phone calls from students on our campus on both sides. Some say we need to participate in this and support our troops in Vietnam. And others say, no, this is not a good war. It's a bad deal. And so I went to Dean Mathis, who was sort of a confidant. He's dean of faculty. Since I was student vice president, I had gotten to know him pretty well. I went to him because it was the first time I'd had people calling me up to 10 o'clock at night in the dorm telling me that I was wrong on either side. And he suddenly slapped his hands on his desk and stood about halfway up and said, "Whoever told you that your opinion wasn't as good as anybody else's?" And kind of took me back. Because I was just flummoxed by the opposing forces. So we went to the city council or the chamber of commerce, whoever was sponsoring this thing. Since McMurray wouldn't participate in a pro war, and ACC did want to, we were kind of neutral. And so we just decided to do a Memorial Day march to remember all fallen soldiers and leave Vietnam out of it. So that was sort of the situation there in 66. There just wasn't much talk about Vietnam.
I wonder,
on our campus.
Did this being exposed to one view versus the other view, did that at the time cause you to look into it a little bit more carefully?
Not at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I was pretty naive. I was very active in campus politics. And I didn't spend much time thinking about it, to tell the truth. Even as I enlisted that at the end of the summer after I graduated, after I got in, we were shown a lot of videos, of course, about the encroaching Red Scare, with movies of Europe and this red blood looking spreading across Eastern Europe.
Sure.
I felt like I was kind of brainwashed into gung-ho-ness and ended up volunteering after I went through advanced infantry training, well, basic training, advanced infantry training, OCS. And I volunteered for 5th Special Forces. Of course, those were the days that Barry Sanders' hit song was on so long.
Why did you decide to enlist rather than wait to be drafted? Take your chances.
Well, I couldn't get a job. I didn't know when I would be drafted. And I didn't want to just get that summer job was over. And I didn't want to just loll around the house. And I just decided to get it over with. So after OCS at Fort Lee, Virginia, mission as a lieutenant, they sent me down to Fort Benning for jump school, paratrooper school, and jungle training. got to Long Bien, which is the repo depot, is the air base north of Saigon. And that's where the planes from the U.S. bring troops in. And then they clean them up and fuel them up. And guys going home after serving a year in Vietnam would get on board and get back home. And I hooked up with the Special Forces liaison, captain. He said, set tight and we'll send transportation for you in 2 or 3 days. And I never heard from him. And there was a bulletin board outside the headquarters office that we had to check twice a day. Once about 11 before noon, and then one about 4 before 5 o'clock for orders. And I was there 10 days with no orders. And finally, I got orders that kept sending me to the Mekong Delta, to 53rd General Support Group headquarters. And we supplied the entire Mekong Delta. And basically, I think my orders were changed from Special Forces to this support group because I had a new degree in accounting and or in business administration and had a lot of accounting.
Mm-hmm.
And the, their records were a mess. There was lost equipment everywhere. So I spent time going around the Mekong inventory and looking for things like 20-ton cranes, airfield fire trucks, and stuff that were on our books, but we had no idea where they were. And we finally found the fire truck up at Long Bien that had been damaged in a rocket attack and had been to the Philippines for repair. And when they sent it back, I think they thought it was more critical in Long Bien Bontao, and so they shipped it there, but we never got notified, and it was still on our books. And so I finally got up there and found it, found the same serial number and all, and got them to sign for it. But that's what I did. I think the reason they changed my orders is they just needed somebody who understood property records to sort that out.
Yeah.
It was a mess. And we couldn't. We couldn't keep up. We had a huge supply yard with Connexes. We kept locked, but they could cut the locks off. And we had trouble keeping up with stuff. There was a lot of sheets. A GI, if he lost his sheets on his bunk, he could sign a statement of loss, and it would be $2.50 deducted from his next paycheck. But you could go downtown and you could find the same sheets, that cotton cloth, at $5 a sheet. So it was trying to hold water in a sieve.
Yeah.
They could make money by taking their sheets off their bunk downtown and selling it for a little bit and, you know, drinking and stuff.
Yeah, you're trying to deal with the black market in addition to just the general things that are going to get lost and go by the wayside combat zone anyway.
Yeah.
Well, let me interrupt you there, Terry, if you don't mind. I'd like to go back a little bit to your time in the States and in the military. Not necessarily going into a whole lot of detail, but here you were, a West Texas kid. How did the military training treat you? How did you do in the military? Say basic training and then on all the way up.
Yeah. I did very well. I've always fit in pretty well and avoided controversy usually, which didn't serve me well as an officer. But, it gave me it beefed me up a lot, and my endurance was much greater. In fact, I weigh less now. I'm losing weight. after I came back from Vietnam, I was, still had 6 months to finish my 3-year obligation. And so I had put down, I wanted 4th Army, which was Texas and Oklahoma. I guess Louisiana was included in 4th Army. And I regretted that later because I didn't realize that they assigned me to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, which is, there's nothing there much except Lawton, which is a typical, kind of like Killeen, a typical military gate town.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot where I was going with that. My memory was, anyway. I wish I had put Germany or England or something on what we call dream sheets when I was leaving Vietnam, because I had volunteered, which they weren't getting any volunteers in those days. The anti-war sentiment was growing faster than the war spirit. And, so I put down, I wanted to go home, basically. After about a month, I visited college buddies from Natalie and, of course, my parents and family and everybody. And after about a month, I was ready to do something else. I'm pretty sure if I'd have put Germany down, I'd have got it because they were really encouraging people who volunteered to make a career of it. And they would give you, after volunteering for Vietnam, they'd give you pretty much anything. But I spent that last 2 months at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, before I was discharged. And I moved to Austin because I'd been here once before and liked it. And knew if I couldn't find a job right away, that I would be able to enroll in UT and get the GI Bill. But I did get a job as a tax examiner, motor fuels tax examiner for the state, which I did not enjoy. It was the most boring thing I'd ever done. It was before computers. And so we were running 10-key calculators and using 32-column spreadsheets to keep up with motor fuels that were being shipped everywhere. And of course, if DX Sunray had shipped something, truck of petroleum from Oklahoma, headed Texas, it might be sold twice and change destinations. And so it was pretty complicated to keep up with it. And I had Texaco. Everybody had a big account. And then you had several small ones. Each service station had to have an account to pay taxes. And there was one in West Texas. It was on the highway south from Carlsbad, New Mexico, where you hook up the 10 and go to El Paso. And it was 100 yards inside Texas. Jurisdiction. This guy reminded me of my dad a lot. He had a small service station. He wasn't well educated. And I'd get letters. I took care of his accounts, so they all came to me. And I'd get letters from him written on brown paper grocery bags in handwriting, explaining one thing or another. He would miss a payment. Sending the letter, and it was pretty arbitrary. It, penalties of interest plus the principal. And, that went on for 6 months or so. And then about didn't hear anything from him. He just quit writing. And at one point, when we switched to computers, we changed the form so it was more adaptable to the computer scheme.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I'm just going to sell this liquefied fuel, liquefied gas, because I can't figure your form out. So he eliminated one of his entire products just because he couldn't figure out how to do a computer form.
Huh.
And I always identified with that guy because he reminded me of my dad. We were taking my daughter. We visited my sister and brother-in-law in Midland, and we were taking my daughter to Carlsbad. And I realized that highway, and we could go due west out of there until we hit that highway, and then we could go north into New Mexico. And I knew where that service station was at the intersection. And so I said, let's go by there. I'd like to see if that station's still there. By there, there was nothing but the slab and the islands where the pumps had been, but there was nothing but concrete.
Hmm.
And it was gone. And, anyway, I worked at the state for a year and I quit. I was hanging out with UT students who were against the war, and they were asking me questions all the time about, well, what is going on? Why did you do this? We'd drink coffee and go over it. I didn't know anything about the history of Vietnam, and I learned more and more. And while I was working at the state, and then after the Kent State massacre, I got up from my desk and went down and joined the protest march, which was about 20,000 people from UT.
Hmm.
And then after that, I went back to my desk. A few weeks after I'd been there, exactly a year, I didn't want to go before a year was up just because of the records following.
Right.
And I resigned and sold my sports car, TR250 Triumph. And I sold it, packed all my personal stuff up from my friend's house. Hitchhiked to California and San Francisco Bay Area, down the coast through Carmel, the sea. And didn't find any place to stop or really land. And I was getting low on funds, so I decided it was time to go back to Austin and enroll at UT as a graduate student. So I came back and enrolled in what was called then, they don't have any more, self-directed graduate study.
Hmm.
Had a bachelor's already. And you could pick and choose the graduate courses you wanted to take. And while I was doing that, I, of course, was talking to the people about Vietnam. I was starting to see that it wasn't straightforward. And ended up going to Sunday afternoon potluck where everybody would bring something to contribute. And it was a group called Direct Action, and they were protesting the war. And I got more and more involved with them. And at one point, there was this GI from Bergstrom Air Force Base, and it was before it had been converted to, when we still had Mueller, private airport. He said he was going to publish a newsletter that he needed to help distribute at the gates. There were three gates leaving Bergstrom Air Force Base. And he came to this Direct Action meeting to get some help distributing these. And someone there says, well, you need to help you can distribute those Vietnam veterans who were against the war. And there was no organization like that. And I was there, and he said, well, are there any veterans here? And I was the only one that was there. And so
When was this, Terry?
Jeff Jones offered me support. He was obviously giving me time to Monday the meeting at his government office, at his student government office. He opened a closet using any poster material, paints, anything you need is here. And just take what you need whenever you need it. He introduced me to this university employee that kind of took care of campus politics. And you could just tell her what you needed to share the market in there. And so I started a group that I was calling Vets for Peace. And not knowing that there was already a national organization.
Right. And, when did you form this group, Terry?
Well, it must have been, it must have been the spring of 70.
Okay.
After I hitchhiked to California and back. And once we got going, there was probably a dozen of us. Got a call, Jeff Jones called me. He says, I've got a call from some folks at UT Arlington that want you to call them. And I called and got Randy Floyd, John Floyd, who had been an Air Force pilot, and he had gone to the Paris Peace Talks to testify that he had bombed Laos. Everybody was denying it happened. Nixon and everybody said, no, no, we never did that. But he said, they didn't tell us our target, but they would give us a direction, a heading, and watch us on radar and have us, you know, move toward the east or west or whatever. And finally, they would tell you when to unload your load. Tell him that we're going to be bombing the bombers, but he said, you don't get to fly these big bombers without having some idea of map reading and where you were. And he knew, he said, that they were bombing outside of Vietnam when the U.S. government was claiming we won. And so he had called me and he said, I've got a call from the group in Washington, D.C. Big protest in the spring, and they want us to bring as many Vietnam vets as we can get together out there.
Is this spring of 70 or 71?
Let me look at my notes here. It was 71.
Okay, so was this the Dewey Canyon 3, perhaps?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I got... five or six of us. And John Niffin took his Volkswagen van. We all loaded up in it and drove to Arlington and met up with the guys, the vets from UT Arlington. And they had a church bus that had been loaned to them and money enough to get us all to Washington for this weekend in three. And so we loaded up and took off. And had balloons that we were passing out to kids wherever we'd stop. And we went to Washington for the Dewey Canyon 3. And that's when I learned about the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And talked to them, and they said, well, if you're in Vets for Peace, you can't do this. There was a huge feud going on between Vets for Peace VVAW, because Vets for Peace was a small organization that was a front for the YSA, the Young Socialist Alliance.
Right.
And they felt like they were the leaders for all protests and wanted us to fall in line behind them. But they wouldn't cross a picket line or a police line. And we weren't willing to do that. We were going to charge the line if we had to. And so they, we split ways. That's for peace. Just as the LBJ Library was opening here.
Hmm.
And that was a big protest there because Westmoreland, LBJ, Nixon, all those people were there. And it was a pretty big protest. And we continued. We did a march from Fort Worth to Dallas. Sponsored a lot of protests. The Carl Hampton Brigade in Houston. He was a member of the People's Party, which was a predecessor to the Black Panthers.
Hmm.
And he had been assassinated, shot by an off-duty policeman with a deer rifle from the roof of a church about a block from their office. And for this big march in Houston, we went down and played a part with it. GIs from Fort Hood and that sort of thing. And that went on pretty actively until they started winding down the ground war and turning it into an air war.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I had much less voice in an air war because I hadn't been. And there was a fine line between being a full-time protester and a street person. And I'd gotten married and decided I needed a real job. And I wanted to try to recoup some of my karma. So I wanted to get into health care. And I went to a health care recruiter at the Texas Hospital Association headquarters here. He looked at my transcripts and some of my history and says, well, you've done a lot of photography, you've done a lot of silk screening, protest signs and stuff. And he said, you should try radiology. It's like taking photographs, but you don't use visible light. And so within a week, I was in X-ray school at Seton.
Hmm.
And since I had a bachelor's degree already, I was the only student at Seton Hospital. It was an in-house school. So they let me skip the first part and just go straight into it. About a year and a half, I was writing a physics paper for class, and I was trying to figure out, since you can't focus X-rays with a lens like you can line, I was trying to figure out how they did the double helix, that book, Double Helix,
mm-hmm.
I read it, didn't understand how they could get those patterns showing the molecular structure of DNA if they couldn't focus the X-rays. And while I was reading about that, the wave nature of X-ray, I kept running across ultrasound, these waves, sound waves. And I was asking at Seton some physicians about this stuff. It sounded pretty good to me. One new physician from San Francisco, he went to the University of California, San Francisco. He says, yeah, it's coming. He said, they had it in the back room, but just the big boys got to play with it. I never did see it, but he said, it is. It's really coming along. So I started requesting that we order it from the administration. Yes, anything over $10,000 has to go through the Pope, the Catholic Church, or the Seton Hospital. And it took about a year and a half before the first instrument came to Austin. And I was on the loading dock, basically. And got involved with it. They gave me a textbook and put the sonographic instrument in a cubicle down in ICU that wasn't being used. And said, see if you can figure this thing out. So I had it open and looking at the liver and gallbladder in the textbook, and scanning my own liver and gallbladder until I could get pictures that looked kind of like what they showed in the textbook. And after 3 days down there playing with it, the surgeon stuck his head through the curtain and says, they tell me you can see gallstones with this thing. And I showed him in the textbook, and I said, here's my gallbladder. I don't have any stones, but there's a, what my gallbladder looks like in the textbook. This is what it looks like with stones. And he says, well, they've got a, one of my patients down in radiology, and they're looking for gallstones, and they can't see anything with x-ray. He said, would you take a look? And so I said, sure. And they brought him down there on a stretcher, and I scanned him and measured three gallstones at just under 1 centimeter in diameter, each one. And I said, I showed him the pictures. And he says, I'm going to surgery on this. He went in and took the gallbladder out and had three stones just like I had measured. And I was just golden after that.
I bet.
Because it was brand new in town. Nobody knew. It hadn't been in any of the physicians' curriculum yet. It was so new. It came to town in 76. I never looked back. Once I got into sonography and we started getting enough patients, I quit doing x-ray completely. I was in x-ray for 8 years, and then, which my oncologist thinks may have had something to do with me getting this problem with my blood now. Too much x-ray. Anyway, the business for sonography kept growing. It got more and more and more. We finally hired a sonographer who had lived in Austin and had gone to Denver to learn sonography at the Unirad, the plant where they built them in Denver. And she came back to Austin. We hired her. And then we kept getting more and more referrals until we were each doing over 20 patients a day, which is patient abuse, basically, as well as sonographer abuse. And we tried to find somebody else that wanted to do it or knew how to do it. We couldn't find anybody, and so Dr. Hill, who was president of the group we were working with, radiology group, said, well, maybe we need to get ACC to start a school. And we talked to them, and they said they weren't sure there was enough interest in it that they could have a class in it or have a program to do it. And so ARA, Austin Radiological Association, gave me a fourth of my time to do clinical rounds during the day, during the week, to check on students. And I taught two nights a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, at ACC, and kept the class full. And I got it accredited nationally, and I was program director there for 4 or 5 years, and had sort of a falling out with the department chair because I went to Half Price Bookstore and went to buy some books, and they had a sign there that said, faculty and students can get a discount. And so I said, I teach at ACC, I'd like the discount. And they said, you have to give us a business card to prove you're on the faculty. So I went back to the dean of our department and said, well, I want to get business cards because I can't get the discount. And she says, well, you're just a part-time teacher. We can't give you a business card. Anyway, we had a big falling out and I quit. And about that time, journal for diagnostic medical sonography. There was an advertisement for someone to start a school at the University of Arkansas Medical School in Little Rock. And my grandparents had had a farm in western Arkansas, so I'd spent most summers up there at one time or another, and sometimes Christmas. And I liked Arkansas. I knew what it was like. It was pretty and it didn't worry me. In 1994, I was at the National Society of Diagnostic Medical Sonographers meeting in Chicago, and I said, does anybody know anything about sonography in Arkansas? Because there's a job there. And the only thing anybody said was, well, I don't think they've got much of as good a pay scale as most places. But they were good to me. And so Lucy and I moved to Little Rock in 1996. Started the first program in the state at the University Medical School and UAMS, it's the University of Arkansas for Medical Science, we call it medical school, but it was the medical school, the School of Nursing, Allied Health, and all of that stuff. It's a big school. And so I went up there and started the program and got it going and got it accredited. Got it moved from a certificate program to a bachelor's degree, one of the first 20 in the United States. And I stayed there until I turned 66 and retired, or semi-retired. The dean wanted me to take some courses. I had moved the most of the senior courses online courses because when we started the bachelor's degree, we needed both cardiac and vascular surgeons to take students, and there weren't 3 million people in the whole state, so there were no big clinics. And so we worked out a deal where we could put the seniors online and teach them online. Go to clinics in Fayetteville or Clarksville. We sent them all over the state. Sent two to Indianapolis. One went to Paris, Texas. One went to Charleston, South Carolina. And they all had went to work when they graduated after doing their senior year online there and working clinical there. They were all hired in at those hospitals, so it was working very well. And the dean asked if I could continue teaching because he didn't want to have to hire another full-time right then. And so I agreed to take 4 courses with me, and I taught one course in the fall, 2 in the spring, and 1 in the summer. And I continued that from 2010, and this May will be my, I told them I can't teach anymore after this. My health's failing. So this May, I'll finish up with my last 2 courses, and I'll be done with it. And I'm basically now just finishing those up and trying to do some gardening, but this, blood disease I've got, I don't have enough red cells, I don't have enough white cells, I don't have enough platelets, I don't clot well, and I just run out of breath real quick. chemo every day for a week, once a month. It's going to be 5 or 6 months of it. And next week will be my third week. And then after I finish that, depending on my numbers, I go in every Monday and have blood drawn to see how my cell count is changing. And after we finish these, depending on the numbers, this summer, I think they said June or July, they're going to do a bone marrow transplant.
Okay.
They're going to basically isolate me, give me heavy chemo, make my hair fall out, kill everything, all the cells and everything, and then take 3 days to let that chemo clear out of my system, and then they'll give me by IV some, they're hoping, younger stem cells that the bone marrow will then take and start making into the cells that I need.
Sure.
And that's basically where I'm at now. It's just waiting.
Yeah, it sure has.
I've spent 45 years in diagnostic sonography now. And I feel like I've recouped most of my karma after Vietnam.
Yeah, I made a note about that, and I want to get back to that later on. Why don't we stop there for today, Terry?
Sure, okay.
This is Kelly Greger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Terry Dubose. Today is 9 May 2018. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Dubose is joining me by telephone again from Austin, Texas. Terry, you gave me a great background framework for your experiences both in Vietnam and coming home from the war, and of course your medical career, which was long and distinguished, which you're just now finishing up, as I understand it. Today I'd like to go back and have you tell me about your time in Vietnam in terms of what you saw was going on in the war, your thoughts on the war, the people, as much detail as you can on that. So you get to Vietnam, and of course you're not with the 5th Special Forces Group, you wind up with the 53rd General Support Group there in August of 67. Tell me about Vietnam for a college graduate from West Texas, an officer working with the support group, the 53rd Support Group.
Well, I guess I got that job. I don't know why my orders were changed when I left the United States. I had orders for 5th Special Forces Group. I hooked up with the liaison guy. He said, we'll sit tight for 2 or 3 days. We'll send transportation. I sat there 10 days before orders came down, assigned me to the 53rd General Support Group. And I was probably one of the more fortunate assignments that you could have. I was in the headquarters and headquarters company, and property book officer and XO, and we had detachments all over the Mekong Delta, and I was in an office basically after that, and I think it was because I just graduated with a business administration degree, and their property records were a disaster over there.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time.
it was as if they pulled the ship up to the docks and just started throwing everything out onto the docks and said, grab what you need. And there were no records that helped much. And you may have to call me here. I'm not sure where I'm going with this. I had several different roommates in bachelor officer's quarters. My first one was an Australian helicopter pilot. And he ran sort of a commissary, you know, moved in when I came back from the office that afternoon. I found somebody new had moved in, and the wall across from my bed was stacked to the ceiling with cases of that Australian beer, Foster's. He would take orders from the other people in his wing, or whatever they call it in Australia, and he would fly over home for supplies. He always brought back as much beer as he could get on the plane. And he frequently, I can't remember his name, but I would frequently wake up at about 5 in the morning as he was getting ready to go to the airfield. Pop 2 beers down on the way out before they flew off in their helicopters for doing whatever they did. And then another roommate I had was the APO, the post office for the Mekong Delta. And he had 9 detachments down there, and I was the property book officer for all of them. He had to go down to the Mekong, I drove to for inventory once in a while, that sort of thing. And I can't remember what happened to him after he rotated back to the United States. I lost track of everybody. It was really probably being in Vung Tau. He couldn't have been in a better place. It was in-country R&R center. And the officers' club was in an old French hotel, and had a kitchen separated from the hotel part by a breezeway, which a lot of the buildings in South Vietnam had. And that was where the bar was, between the restaurant and the hotel. We spent a lot of time, of course, down there in the bar after work and the weekend. And that's kind of the way mine went. I had it pretty luxurious, really.
Yeah.
After I got to Vung Tau.
Yeah, that's an ideal place to be if you have to be there.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of funny. I didn't know where I was going. I'd been at Benoit, the Bravo Depot, where planes came in from the United States and they left loaded with guys leaving, going home. And since I'd been there 10 days by the time I got my orders, everybody getting off the plane from the United States, a lot of them left paperback books that they had read on the way over. And I started collecting those up and putting them on, you know, how those hooches were built with the screen. It had a metal roof and screens all the way around with louvers to keep the rain from blowing in. And there was a 2x4 shelf that ran along there to connect that screen wire to. And I was just lining the old paperbacks that came in off the planes from the United States up on there. And guys coming in from the field to get on the plane to return, I'd let them just pick a book out and take it with you. I was sort of a librarian for the BOQ officers for 10 days. And then there was a bulletin board you had to check twice a day. And they said, oh, I never got down there. I always wanted to, but I never could get down there. But It was pretty soft. It was a back beach area. It was white, sandy beaches in the South China Sea. And then the front beach was in town, on town. And it was pretty rocky. But there was lots of bars, that sort of thing, up and down the streets, all over the place.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things were going on in Bung Tao as an in-country R&R place? What sort of things were going on that would be different from, say, you know, another place in the Delta?
Well, like I said, a whole lot of bars. And what they call B-girls, the bar girls, that was there to get the guys to buy more booze, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And there was prostitution going on. It was hard to describe, really. It was sort of a carnival area. Dock where stuff came in from the Mekong Delta, and we unloaded there, and it was just we'd go to the back beach, cook steaks, drink beer, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of try to work on the books during the week. Go to the beach on the weekends. It's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. What would a typical day be like for you? Are you working in the office most of the time? Are you traveling most of the time? How would that work out typically?
Most time I was in the office. I would have to go down to the Mekong. Basically, after somebody had had a firefight or a rocket attack or a mortar attack, inventory, and that was when we would turn in statements of loss and stuff, and we'd write everything off that we could, just trying to get it off the books, because we didn't know what was going on. But I'd go to Mito, Gongtan, Kanto, Sok Train, all over the place. The typical day is I'd get up and go to the club and get breakfast. Usually there were two clubs there. Pink Panther was a subsidiary officers club. And that's where I usually went for breakfast, because they had a real good cook that had been trained by the French there.
Hmm.
And then several of us lieutenants would meet there for breakfast. Various offices, and had an office, had Sergeant Spillman and Sergeant Norris. Sergeant Norris was the one who kept me out of jail, I think. He was helping me with the property books, and had three or four other. They would send guys who would in some bad situations further north, and they would sometimes transfer them to Bung Tao.
Yeah.
They'd get them out of harm's way because they were giving them. Like, I had one guy that I don't know where he'd been, it was further up country, and they caught him in a bar downtown with a couple of hand grenades in his pocket.
Hmm.
To blow some girl or somebody up. I don't know what it was all about. But we finally got the chaplain, get him sent home, and had a young guy who was newly married before he came over. His wife had bought a Corvette convertible, and he was worrying, wanting to know, well, who's taking this picture of her laying on the hood of that Corvette? And he was worried about her and what was going on.
black market must have been the scourge of your existence there, I would think.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it was. Like, the VOQ where I was an old French, ironically called the Pax Hotel. And it was an old French hotel. And we had tons of roaches, big tree roaches. And they had kind of covered the pipes in the corner of the bathroom and shower with plywood. DDT or those aerosols for bugs to supply. They never came. But I could go downtown to the black market and I could buy them. OD Green spray cans.
They came off the boat and went straight to the black market, it sounds like.
Somehow, yeah. I wasn't party to all of that. Anyway, there's a long story about those roaches and stuff and fighting. But things like, as far as black market goes, the company commander for headquarters company captain, and he and the major, who was the officers' club, major who ran the officers' club, and we had slot machines. That sort of thing down there. And they had a grudge against each other over, didn't matter what her name was. She was French Vietnamese, beautiful, petite, young woman who had waited tables in the officers' club until our captain hired her away to work in his office. They had this feud going on. One night at dinner, the company commander turned to me and he said, "You're a lieutenant in the Quartermaster Corps." He said, "How do they ship chickens? Are they cut up already?" And I said, "Yeah, they're cut up." He says, "Are all the parts there?" And I said, "Yeah, I think they ship whole chickens cut up, ready to, you know, cook." And he says, "Well, how come when I order chicken here, I never get any chicken wings? Are they in there?" And I said, "Yeah, I think they are." And anyway, he got to investigate and he found out that the officers' club was because the chicken wings always came back when somebody ordered chicken. The chicken wings always came back untouched for the most part, but this captain just happened to like chicken wings and he never got them. He finally figured out what was happening. They were selling them out the back door of the officers' club on the market. And he busted the guy and got him shipped back to the States. And Tweed, the girl's name, they were fucking cheating over, of course. And he left the country. She was pregnant. I don't know. It was just not a pretty scene.
Certainly be frustrating, I would think, for someone in your position to have to deal with the black market, but then perhaps having, like you said, the roach spray, you have to go on the black market to get the things you need. It had to be frustrating, I would think.
Oh, yeah, it was. I had a college buddy who had, it was after the Tet Offensive, and we had been caught kind of off guard in Longtown. We were the largest air base in Vietnam that wasn't hit during Tet. It was on the end of a peninsula. And, couple of weeks, the commander at our headquarters got fired over the fact that we weren't ready for Tet. And they brought in a new commander for the group. And he had us filling sandbags every night, took in a cloth. And, but, you know, for the hooches and the perimeter and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And since I had to be down there every night at 10 o'clock, one night I was inside the company headquarters, which was just one of those screened-in hooches. And I was headed for the back door, and the lights were on inside the office, and it was dark outside. And as I was headed toward the back screen door, actually the front screen door, I heard somebody say, "Dubose, is that you? What the hell are you doing here?" And I pushed the door open, and this guy had been my suite mate at the dorm in Abilene, Arden Center.
Huh.
And he was seemed pretty elated until we got the screen door open, and he saw that I was an officer. And he immediately, his demeanor changed. And I suspect he was sent for R&R because he was involved in fragging somehow.
Is that right?
He wouldn't talk about it. He wouldn't talk about when he was there. I hardly got him to talk at all. But the second night he was there, I got him to go down to one of the bars with me. We sat and drank beer and talked about what he was doing, what I was doing, and what he needed. So I can get you a lot of that stuff if you can get it back. So we've got a new duffel bag and put two or three pairs of boots, some poncho liners, and other stuff like that that you couldn't get down in the field. He took it all back with him. He was in the call. And I never heard from him again after that. But he was pretty freaked when he realized I was an officer and a lieutenant. He kind of clammed up a little bit.
That's really interesting.
I'm not sure exactly what the story was. He didn't talk about it. We could talk about college. We could talk about most anything we wanted to. Supplies he needed, he couldn't get. Those boots and stuff like that, combat boots. And we had just comics as full up. We could keep them from getting ripped off. Bolt cutters were a hot item in Bumtown.
Yeah, I bet. Let me ask you this, Terry. You're in Bungtow, but you do travel around. See some things, and you use the phrase too naive or green for being there, especially for what you were trained for, your original orders with special forces.
Right.
But here you are. You see a lot of things in the rear in Bungtow, but you also travel around to these different bases. You mentioned a number of them that you would visit after rocket attacks or what have you. What are you seeing about the here you are, in your words, naive and green. I mean, are you a believer in the war at this point when you go over there?
It's hard to say. I basically told myself I was going to go. I volunteered because I wanted to see for myself what was going on, because I was seeing some of the news and stuff after I graduated, and I couldn't get a job. Listed. Of course, I went to OCS, jump school, air troop, and jungle training. Down in the Mekong, the airfields were mainly built up by silt from the Mekong. They had barges with dredge lines. If they drag mud up from the bottom and dump it, they build these dams around the airfield. And they would fill it with silt. And the dust was just incredible when those helicopters would come in and out on those airfields. They had all that silt. One time I was down there inventorying, we were looking for a 20-ton crane on those drag links that dragged the mud up.
Mm-hmm.
And the young lieutenant who was signed for it had no idea where it was. And he knew it was on the property books, but he didn't know where it was. And he says, well, let's go look around the perimeter, son, and see what we can find. It was still, this is right after lunch. And so we were in his Jeep. Down below the berm that held the silt for the airfield in a swampier area, trying to go around the edge of it. And on this road below the swamp, I mean, the berm that held the thing, it must have been 30 feet high. It was a pretty high berm. And we got stuck. Thousand gallon tank got out away into the Gulf, the ship's captain said, "You want breakfast?" I said, "Come on down to the, I forget what they call it in the Navy, the kitchen." Anyway, we went down, and we were having a great breakfast when all of a sudden I heard some machine gun fire. I kind of started. He said, "Don't worry about it. They're just testing them. Now that we're out away from the docks, they're testing the guns on board to make sure everything's ready." And that's when he told me, he said, "Yesterday, there was a barge like this that was going out of LST, what do you call it?" And he said, "They were hit. Along the banks." And he says, "If we get hit," he says, "there's a pretty strong wind from whatever direction it was," I can't remember. He says, "If we get hit, this thing catches on fire," he says, "you go off on the windward side and swim as fast as you can toward the wind. Because the wind will blow the JP-4 and the stuff away from you, which, of course, looked like it was a mile across there to me. It'd be like telling me to swim across the Mississippi. It was just, wasn't going to happen. But fortunately, we made it without getting hit. But that tightened me up a little bit until we got on up the river. And then when I was coming back, I had to go down to Sauk Train. So I called a helicopter. After I finished the inventory and talking to the people down there in the office, I went out to the officers' club, which was this little bitty beach, and found a couple of helicopter pilots. They were trying to decide if they were going to stay there for the night or go somewhere else. And I says, "Y'all want to fly me to Guantanamo?" And they says, "Yeah, we'll do that." They flew me to Guantanamo and got me out of there. I don't know what they did. I think they found it. There were quarters there for people out at the air base. And they probably went out there and found a bed. But it was pretty loose around there. There's a lot going on. A lot of personal stories of GIs.
Did you encounter any sort of issues with drugs, or race relations, or violence? Anything that we kind of traditionally assign to life in the rear in Vietnam?
Yeah, there was pot everywhere, and I once in a while had kids approach me with little baggies of white powder. I assumed it was heroin or cocaine, or probably heroin.
Yeah.
That close to the triangle. And you could just walk down that front beach and smell pot just everywhere, coming out of the bars. And of course, I was pretty naive. I had never smoked. And I was actually afraid that if I smoked, I'd lose my senses. D.C. had come get me or something. I don't know. It wasn't realistic, but I didn't know any better, having come from a Baptist university. But that kind of stuff went on all over the place. Back Beach, was a bipod. Had a young lieutenant, and I had not a young lieutenant, a young specialist, Spec 5, who I enjoyed were trying to get him to smoke pot. And we were just joking around. I said, I'd have to burn it. He says, well, that's what we intended for you to do. I said, no, I'm the incinerator. And anyway, I had a pretty good relationship with the enlisted men, except for the ones who were just nuts.
Yeah.
And hated the lieutenants. But there was a lot of that kind of stuff that went on. I never had any trouble with heroin.
What was discipline and morale like as you saw it there, 67, 68?
Right where I was, it was pretty good. I mean, we were secure, one of the safest places in the country at the time. And there were a few, you know, like I said, who were just, one of the guys that was caught downtown with two hand grenades. He was just wacko.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the other, you know, I actually enjoyed hanging with them more than I did some of the officers who were kind of too starched. And I don't know, it's hard to explain. Mustard out and give them poisoning, food poisoning. Because police officer could be court-martialed for that. But it was, I don't know, it was kind of, I was way too green to be in that situation.
Yeah. What were your thoughts on the war itself, Terry? You went over there admittedly green. Is this something that you believed was the right thing to do?
Well, I couldn't get a job. I think I told you about interviewing right at the end of my senior year.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all had that spiel, and they end up asking me three questions and stand up and have my business card. But call us back in 2 years.
Yeah, once you're done with your military obligation.
Right.
Yeah.
They weren't back then, JET was the buzzword. It was junior executive training. And they said they weren't going to put anybody to a JET program. Pardon Simmons, I didn't have a strong opinion of the war. I didn't know what Vietnam was. I wasn't interested in campus politics, and I was world politics.
Right.
And when I enlisted, I was basically telling myself, well, you can go see what this is about, and what the truth is. And when I got in, of course, Barry Sadler's Green Beret was top of the list, hit parade, or whatever you call it, top 40. And I was brainwashed by the military. I'm convinced to jump into that and volunteer for it. And I think they've realized when I got to Vietnam that I wasn't cut out for Green Berets. Probably what saved my life. But I didn't really turn against the war until about the time I was getting home.
What made you turn?
The first people I tried to hook up with when I got to Austin, I came here because I couldn't find a job after I got out of the military. I could always go to the UT and get the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the first people I looked up were graduate students here that I had known at Hardin-Simmons, particularly fraternity brother and his wife, who was working on a master's in art here. And I started hanging with them and went down to the Union Building where the coffee shop was. Started hooking up with people who wanted to pick my brain about why I went over there and volunteered and what was going on. And that's when I started finding out more about the history of Vietnam and the end of World War II. When Ho Chi Minh thought he and his guerrillas had helped fight the Japanese to get them out of Vietnam. And he thought that we were going to support him in establishing a new government. But we wanted, as near as I can tell, we wanted France back on their feet in Europe economically. Because rubber had been such a big deal in World War II, and we didn't have a good synthetic rubber until 65. And the U.S. Army was paying Michelin a royalty for every rubber tree we damaged during the occupation. Pretty sure Michelin had something to do with us staying there and not turning it over to the Vietnamese and getting French Indochina back in there, because we weren't even harvesting rubber. We didn't have a good substitute yet. And they paid royalties to Michelin until 65. That's learning more about the history, talking to these San Antonio war people at UT, and seeing more and more what a fiasco it was historically. And that's when I really lost my mind, was talking to these anti-war protesters who were asking questions I couldn't answer. Slowly changed, and then when they dedicated the LBJ Library here, Westmoreland and all those folks, Nixon, all those folks were here for it. And that was when I learned about Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and ended up at Duke Canyon 3 in Washington. I think I've got the sequence of that stuff out of order.
I could imagine it's only been 50 years.
Yeah.
No, that's perfectly fine. And in fact, it probably brings us to a good point to stop here today, Terry.
Okay.
We've been gone for about an hour now.
Yeah.
This is Kelly Greger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Terry Dubose. Today is 16 May, 2018. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Dubose is joining me by telephone again from Austin, Texas. Terry, when we left off last time, we'd gotten you through your experience in Vietnam and brought you home and started to talk about the early days of the anti-war movement or countering the anti-war movement. When you come home from Vietnam, where do you come into country? Do you remember?
Travis Air Force Base.
Okay. Now, Travis, obviously being where it was located, a lot of other folks in the San Francisco Bay Area reported or recalled being treated or being greeted by anti-war protesters. Was this the case for you when you arrived
nope.
in the summer of 68?
Nope.
What was that scene like for you when you came home?
As best as I can remember, when we got off the plane, there were buses that would take us to the airports or wherever we needed to go. So I got on a bus to the airport, LAX, I guess it was, to fly home.
Hmm.
Of course, wore a uniform because we got standby pretty easily. And so when I got back from Vietnam, I came to Austin because I knew if I couldn't find a job,
right.
And get the GI Bill to survive. But I did find a job after 2 weeks of searching in the State Controller's Office, Motor Fuels Division.
Right, yeah.
And it was kind of boring. I was there when we switched from paper reports to computerized. That process. I was there exactly 1 year. I stayed until 1 year, but when the Kent State massacre happened, I got up from my desk and went down and joined the protesters who were walking through downtown from UT and sort of circling around downtown and back to UT. It was about 20,000. And wasn't too long after. The state and sold my sports car, hitchhiked to California, and hit the coast at San Francisco, and kind of hung around there for 2 days. Didn't find anything to keep up with anybody, and so I started hitchhiking south. Pacific Coast Highway. Met some really nice people.
What led you out to California?
Well, this was in early 70s, late 70s, it was in the 70s, summer of 70s. guess I was just so fed up with the tax rules, tax laws that I was dealing with that I wanted to get out, so I quit. I was decided to hitchhike in California, which might help me find myself somewhere.
Yeah.
But I hit the coast of San Francisco and went down to the Chinese coast. It was at Laguna Gloria for that big art show. And that was pretty interesting. I found some teenagers who gave me a ride. When we got to the art show,
so these other two guys were veterans as well?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, not Vietnam veterans, but they were veterans like Waterhouse. He served in Monterey at the language school this year, two or 3 years. And I can't remember anybody else. But we decided to organize this Vets for Peace. Direct action potlucks.
Yeah. What would you guys discuss at these meetings, Terry?
Next meeting.
Well, let me ask you this. You have this veterans organization that you're bringing together there at UT. Yeah. What was the, and perhaps there wasn't one particular, and likely wasn't, but what was the foundation for the opposition to the war? Was it against all wars? Was it against policies? Was it against this particular war, particular aspects of the war? Was it a national security issue? Where is the basis, the foundation for the opposition to the Vietnam War?
I think it was just about the Vietnam War draft. Mm-hmm. Students did not want to be drafted. And so they came out in droves to support us. And it was afterwards it started to rest for peace. We got there, we moved everything from our van to the bus, and we started packing up to get going. And somebody had gotten a bunch of balloons that were stamped with make love, not war. And we kept those tied to the bus. Arkansas contingent was kind of came along behind us, so they gave all of us a ride in back to the bus and garage for repairs, and we all rode in to the Eugene 3 with the University of Arkansas crew from Fayetteville. And that went on for a while, and then Nixon came down with this decree that we had to vacate them all. And
it's almost surreal when you think about it.
Oh, it was.
With all these things going on, the veterans, it was war, the Nixon administration getting involved, and then Hare shows up.
Yeah.
Seemingly out of nowhere to perform.
Right.
Pretty crazy times.
It was.
When we think about the Dewey Canyon 3, oftentimes I think what people go to immediately is the throwing of the medals over the fence.
Yeah.
Did you participate in that?
Yeah, I did, although I didn't carry my medals. They gave me a sack full of them that you could take and throw away. I didn't have that many, and I certainly wasn't wearing any of them.
Yeah.
And so I did throw some medals over. I don't know what they were or whose they were.
Just kind of symbolically, since you didn't have yours to throw away.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And that's what a lot of people did, because I don't think any of us ever wore them.
What do you think about this organization? I mean, this is VVAW at this time doing this. What are your thoughts about this group of like-minded veterans?
I like them. In fact, as soon as I got back to Austin, I got our guys together at Austin and I said, I think we need to change the name from Vets for Peace, to Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And we love you. They'd seen the news, the ones that did go with us, and they heard our stories when we came back. And so I called the New York office and told them that we wanted to have a chapter at the University of Texas.
Hmm.
And they said, isn't that where the Vets for Peace are? And I said, well, we organized a group called that. We didn't know there was a national organization. And they said, well, you can't use that name. They are see the library from there. And it split the news media between the two sides.
Hmm.
And they were doing that kind of stuff all the time, trying to obstruct. They felt like they were the only anti-war organization that was valid. And everybody else was just hangers on or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt like everybody should come under their umbrella. But they wouldn't cross the picket line. They wouldn't break the law. And my day tribe here, more radicals, of which the VVAW guys, feminist collective had trash cans they were drumming on and carrying on. They went on all day long. And then in the evening, when it was over, the police or the National Guard or somebody was coming in. And so everybody scattered. And we ended up over at Harden North on the west side of campus. Staying at this Harden North. And it was like a dorm, commercial dorm.
Mm-hmm.
And the people from Duquesne through, well, not Duquesne through, but from the protest at the LBJ Library were protesting in front of this commercial dorm where the dignitaries were staying. That time, somebody came over to me and said, "Terry, what's her name? Liz Carpenter. I think it's her name. She was Lady Bird's press agent."
Okay.
Is that Liz Carpenter?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I think it was. Somebody came over and said, "Liz Carpenter."
What do you think the veterans' role, the anti-war veterans' role was in the anti-war movement? What did you think that you guys had to offer this movement that perhaps other organizations did?
Yeah, well, it turned out to do a King III thing. It hit all of the media nationwide, worldwide. And there were little old ladies from churches bringing cakes and pies and grilled steaks, barbecue. I ate very well there. And somehow the media just picked up on VVAW big time. And we could go out and put your thumb up people listened to BCHS because they felt like we knew what we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas college students who were waiting the draft couldn't say much about the war except they were in
it. Sure.
And BCHS just hit it at the right time. Got a very good response from everybody.
Can you give me kind of a thumbnail sketch of the VVAW, the way it was, maybe established, but also its structure. How was it structured, you know, from the national leadership to the regions and the activities? Give me just a quick sketch of the VVAW as it was and as it operated while you were part of it.
Well, basically, had no officers. They didn't call anybody a captain or general or president or anything. They were all coordinators. And it was pretty cooperative in the way it was organized. And state coordinators themselves, anybody from other states who was a coordinator would go and get voting.
Probably in our library, but I'm not familiar with it, no.
She has a picture of this guy on the front. And he, when we did the Arduino King 3 at Fort Hood, Selene, everybody did it following Christmas with the slogan that if you want to bring the troops home for Christmas, the BVAW is going to go home for Christmas. Protest scheduled at Fort Hood. And this one guy them were Vietnam vets who had been severely injured. And we'd give them a book and talk to them a little bit. After we'd gone down a couple of halls, suddenly the MP showed up and arrested us all. Given letters of, I guess you call them letters of denial. We ever set foot on Fort Hood again, we would be arrested, tried for trespassing. And so that ended that. And we had these, wanted, it was to organize it all, notify the press and all. We couldn't have stuff scheduled too tightly. This guy, that was sort of a mistake. We didn't have any people, the VAW members who were camping out at that lake near there, to keep them occupied between these protests. And this guy that turns to evidence, I can't remember his name.
Would this have been Bill Lehmer?
That's him.
Yeah.
Yep, Bill Lehmer. And he was back at the camp. Telling everybody this is just a waste of our time. Why are we doing this? Let's go do something. And so he got a bunch of them hot and bothered. And so they went down to the LBJ's library. And Kathy Niffin, Kathy DuBose, the first wife, were driving up with a bunch of supplies and stuff for this military for Dallas. They saw these guys and recognized them and told us they had stopped and talked. They came and told us what was going on at Lehman. They was leading a bunch down to the LBJ library. They were going to occupy the LBJ library. And to hell with us. And so I jumped in a van, John Niffin and Wayne. And we drove down. Kind of put the quietest to it, stopped them and explained, you know, this isn't going to help any. We've got the media there, and you're just splitting forces. So they went back with us, but Lehman was still a problem. I was taking photographs at a Leica with a light meter I was using. He says, can I look at that light meter? And he acted like he'd never seen one. As soon as he got it, he clipped it open and turned it straight toward the sun until it pegged out and went dead. And I said, what the hell? He said, I don't know, I just want to see how it works. And it disappeared. Next time he showed up, he was at Gainesville 8.
Bill Lehmer, he was kind of notorious, obviously, within the movement. What do you suppose his role was? Was it as agent provocateur? Was it someone who was there to push the limits to get the BVAW into more trouble? Was this just a personal thing that he wanted to do? I mean, you were talking about handing out brochures and pamphlets and apparently trying to educate people on the war and things like that. What do you think the role was of the FBI?
You know, I don't know. They had something on him, I'm pretty sure. Either a drug bust or something. Because they were manipulating him. Had to be something. You know, he did turn state's evidence against him.
What did you see as the role of the of of VVAW in Texas as regional coordinator, what were your major goals? What did you want to do? And it, aside from the obvious of stopping the war, how did you and those with you hope to help bring this about?
Well, just communicating. We took every opportunity to talk to the press, news media, any kind. And that was mainly it, was just letting the public know that the war was not going well, it wasn't a good deal. And but that was mainly it, was communication with the public.
So what kind of activities do you have the Texas region involved in? What sort of things are you doing? Are there protests, marches, or you tell me, what did you have the Texas region doing?
Well, we did our own Dewey Canyon 3, which was that march from Fort Worth to Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Describe that for me. I've not heard of that.
Well, it was, we had, members of BBAW and their wives and girlfriends who were supporting us. And we did guerrilla warfare kind of stuff in malls. Front of the mall, the buildings. The women would set up like they were cooking in the middle of the mall. And then the GIs would come in and pick over the cooking. Round them up, haul them off, and then go to another mall, repeat it again.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on all the way through Arlington, from Fort Worth to Dallas. It took 3 days for that march.
What kind of effect do you think it had on the folks there in the Metroplex?
It seemed to be pretty favorable. News media started coming out and finding. I wasn't. Those 3 days, I was busy keeping things going and organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't reading any newspapers. There were some. The TV came out and talked to us. Radio announcers, a few of those who were on the TV and newspapers. And basically, supporting us, I think. They helped support us, although they tried to remain neutral. I didn't consider them neutral. I considered them friendly.
Yeah. Well, what about the opposition? Did you face any opposition?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about that.
In Arlington, someplace there, one of those malls, we were confronted with Ku Klux Klan. Guys carrying Confederate flags and calling us traitors. That happened again in Miami at the Republican convention when that gang delay thing happened.
Yeah.
There was a bunch of neo-Nazis that came into the captain. The vets just beat the shit out of them. I wasn't there at that time. I had gone back to school at Seton Hospital. And John Diffin had taken over as state coordinator at that point.
Okay, so it goes from you to John.
Yeah.
And when did you leave the VVAW?
Well, I never left. I still got the membership. I still get the newsletters. Do you get those?
We used to have a collection of them here. We may still, I can't remember.
Yeah, you should be getting them. Like, there was one. Anyway, I forgot what you asked me.
I was just asking about the VVAW. You say it went from you being the coordinator to John Niffen. When did you, okay, I should have said, when did you leave VVAW? Because as you made clear, you never left it. So when did you leave this leadership role and go back to college?
Well, it was after three or four years of protest. And then when Nixon started pulling the ground troops out and turning Vietnam to more of an air war in support of the Vietnamese troops, I had the feeling that there was a fine line between being recognized as a full-time anti-war protester and just a street person.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like, since the Army was no longer there, that I had much of a voice. Plus, I had gotten married and just decided I needed to get a job. Good friend who was an attorney Texas X-ray Technologists Association, ART, in Texas, they were having a review for the National Board exams. And I was going to hitchhike up there for that. And so, Kathy, the first one, wrote me out to I-35 on the north edge of town, let me get out. Stuck my thumb up and had my textbook and stuff, and the first car that pulled over was being driven by a white man. And I got in and he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to Dallas." And he said, "Oh, I am too." And I kept looking at him. And I said, "You look real familiar to me." And he says, "Well, I work at the Texas Hospital Association as a recruiter." And so, 2 years to the day, the guy that got me into the medical field carried me to Dallas for this review for my board exam.
Hmm.
And it just so happened that he picked me up. And after I did the review course up there, there was an awesome people I called the ride back. Pretty close to now.
16th, actually.
It was today. I took and passed my X-ray exams, and my daughter was born. So May 16th is a big date for me.
Yeah, I guess so. Questions for you, not
sure.
A lot. As the war was winding down, you mentioned that you backed away from your activities, but did you remain in touch with the move at all, even though you were going through school? Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
What did that look like?
Not sure I know what you mean.
I'm sorry. What sort of a contact did you keep with the organization? Are you remaining active at all? What is your level of commitment and interest in the VVAW after you leave?
Yeah. Well, I missed two or three protests because I was in school at that time at the hospital. So I missed a lot of that. But I did still keep up with John Niffen and Beverly and a whole bunch. I usually just be at their house. Protests were during the day, and I didn't see them all the time. And so it was really a winding down time for me.
Yeah. What did you think about the way the war came to an end for the U.S., essentially, in early 1973?
Well, it was much too long if you look at the current documentaries about the Pentagon Papers and how the leadership was talking out of both sides of their mouths. One place saying we're doing great, see the light, the tunnel. But then in these reports they're saying this is hopeless, there's no way out of this quagmire. The same people saying both things publicly.
about the end of the war itself in April of 75? Do you remember the events of April 30, 75?
Not really. It was pretty subdued as far as I was concerned. It was a relief. I'm glad it was finally over. But it didn't have a huge effect.
Yeah.
I was really occupied in the hospital at that time.
Sure. Looking back on it, Terry, when you think about your experiences in Vietnam and, of course, your activities in opposition to the war once you got back, what do you think how do you think they affected you the most?
Well, I'm more proud of the protests than I am volunteering for the war.
Mm-hmm.
I convinced myself many years ago that that was the worst mistake I ever made. I can still say that I'm volunteering for that. And the protests, though,
what kind of impact do you think the VVAW had on politics, on the war itself?
Now, I like to think that we shortened it a bit and raised the public consciousness about it and what was wrong with it. And, of course, the Ellsberg papers was the icing on the top.
Mm-hmm.
Proved to everybody that we had been lying to and just drug on. Good reason other than politics. Nobody wanted to say they lost the war.
What do you think about the, after all these years, we still try to wrap our head around what the war was about, what the war means in a variety of ways in this country. You were there, saw the war firsthand, as you'd mentioned. You saw what it was doing to the country back home, and you participated in these efforts to end the war, not just casually sitting by watching it on the television. You got involved and tried to do something about it. So let me ask you, what do you think is the legacy of the Vietnam War? What does it mean? How's that for an impossible question to answer?
No, there's a lot there. It ended the draft, which is a big deal. In fact, I'm starting to have doubts about ending it. It put our military on a mercenary basis, I would say, because it's a poverty draft. Job, but it looks pretty good to me.
talking about the the ending of the draft and the effects that it's had.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting how time kind of intervenes, I guess.
Yeah.
And forces you to look at things differently as you see things play out in real time. After all those years working to stop this, the war itself and the effects that would have with the draft, of course, and moving forward, 50 years later. Interesting.
Yeah. I do think we should bring the draft back for everybody. Even Governor Abbott could answer a phone in his wheelchair.
Right, good point.
There's no reason we should go back there, except the military doesn't want it. And they're in control now. And that's what frightens me about it.
Terry, I think I've exhausted my questions. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
No. Appreciate having the opportunity to talk. This is a complicated period. Still unbelievable.
Funny how that works, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time, sir.
You bet, Kelly.